We're going to be looking at the other world, the world that most of us don't know anything about. Although I just spoke with Miss Lewis, and she has spent some 20 years in the Cameroon, so she has to know quite a bit about that. And we're going to, first of all, think about what the other world is. And does anybody, you know, we call that other world most often the third world. Does anyone know how that got its name? And what is the first and second world?
No, back from Boston.
The first world is the developed country, and I think the second world is sort of the country they think could get up to the first world.
Mm-hmm.
And the third world is the ones that they just sort of shake their head and say, there's too much poverty, I don't know what's going to happen to these people.
No. Well, that's
my recollection of it was that the first world is the United States and Western Europe, the Western nations. The second world is the communist bloc. The third world is what's left over.
That's right. It was designated by a Frenchman who came up with the third world term, and you're both right near that idea.
I will be there.
And the, you know, many people here in the United States think it's a derogatory term to use third world. And yet, I must admit, I've never met anyone from the third world who senses it that much. Some people, therefore, call it the developing world, which is fine. Others will say it's the two-thirds world, because two-thirds of the people live in that world. Huh? But that's right. I once heard a story about a person from the first world and the second world and the third world, and they were meeting at a conference somewhere in Europe, and the individual from the second world said, "Would you excuse me for a while? I want to go out and get something. I'll be back very shortly." And in 5 hours, the fellow finally came back. And the individual from the first world said, "Well, where have you been?" And the third world individual wondered the same thing. And the fellow from the second world said, "Well, I went to buy a hot dog, but I had to stand in the queue for 5 hours, huh?" And the person from the first world said, "What's a queue?"
Yeah.
And the person from the third world says, "What's a hot dog?" And although that was originally said about capitalism and socialism, it applies to the third world too. They don't have that hot dog, and we're going to talk about that. I wondered, first of all, before we look at some maps, if you can tell me anything that for you characterizes the other world, the third world, the world that most of us haven't experienced. What do you think of when you think of the third world?
Uneducated.
Uh-huh.
Poverty.
Poverty.
Okay. Low education.
Resources exploited by others.
Mm-hmm. Poverty.
Lots of children.
Resources exploited.
A desire to have the material wealth of the first world.
High population.
Hunger.
Yes, that could go in here, hunger. Desire, first world status. Any other aspects?
At risk.
What do you mean by that?
As far as defending themselves.
Uh-huh. Defense at risk.
Primitive in terms of development.
Uh-huh.
Or technology.
I'm sorry?
Disease.
Uh-huh.
Sickness.
Yes.
parish and doctors to do anything about it.
Yeah. Few doctors.
Political instability.
Yeah. Those are all good, and they are characteristic in general terms. Some of the other things is, of course, high infant mortality. Low life expectancy. Low education. Poverty, hunger. In the third world, you'll have deforestation, exploitation of women and children.
Awful lot of those things we have right in this country.
You do. In fact, an Indian friend of mine said, to me, speaking about development, he said, no country is developed. No, let me get this right now. If the development of a country is based on the status of its women, no country is developed, said in India. Desertification. And someone has rightly pointed out that a lot of those things are here in our part of the world also. And that's our general picture of the third world. And it's not far off. It's a world where 800 million people are hungry. Someone has said that it takes three people in the developing world or the third world for one of us to enjoy overweight. It's an area where a child dies every 2 seconds, somewhere. 40,000 a day, 17 million a year. And if, you know, many people say what happened during the Holocaust should be on the responsibilities and burden of the Western world. Well, what about those 40 million children who die? To kill that many children with 747, you'd have to have, you see, 100 747s crashing every day loaded with 400 children. Or is it 1,000? You do the arithmetic, it's too much. And one of the problems is that we have always looked at the third world under European eyes and with a European perspective. Someone says exploitation of resources. Indeed, that's true. Colonial Europe saw the Africa, Asia, and Latin America as a place to get resources. Even the map that we used at that time, the Mercator projection, you'll note this is it. Done back about 1500. And you'll notice that the equator isn't even in the middle of the map. And usually you can take a line from corner to corner. And you'll see that it doesn't even come near the equator. And this is the world, traditionally, that we looked at. And when you look at CBS News, that's what you look at. Let's take a look at some of the realities of location. And Here you have the north has got 18.9 million square miles. The south is twice as large. And you'll notice where the line comes between the north and south. North of Mexico, Europe, and then coming through here between Russia, China is in the south. Look at the inequalities, and yet that's how it's depicted. Many of us come from Scandinavian backgrounds. Take a look at the inequality here. 400,000 square miles in Scandinavia. Look at the size it gets on the Mercator, whereas India is 1.3, almost three times the size in terms of square mile, and yet India is considerably smaller in the projection. Is it any wonder that we see the third world differently? There is almost the same size, Alaska and Mexico, and yet there's the difference. And this isn't particularly done by Mercator to distort the world, but you know, when you try and take a round world and put it on a flat projection, something is going to be distorted. And the further you are from the equator, the greater that distortion becomes. And that's why you have, look at Greenland up there, for goodness sake. It's the size of many of the countries. One of the things, and we're going to talk on Friday about Africa, but there again, Africa, and in this case it's projected against the Soviet Union, but Africa is four times the size of the United States. Four times. The United States is roughly 3 million square miles. In Africa, you can see, is almost 12. And if you put the Horn of Africa on St. Louis, Dakar will be in the Hawaiian Islands. And if you took the top of Tunisia and put it on New York, Cape Agulhas in South Africa will be about Santiago, Chile. And again, you see the south, and that is what Africa, Latin America, and Asia is known as, in economic terms, the South, is misrepresented as far as size is concerned. And we can keep going on, and I will take a look at another one that shows comparative size between Europe and Latin America, or South America, actually, not including Central America. And again, you see that it's almost twice as large. There are a lot of other ways you can project maps, of course, and I want to show you one way is by population. This is a graphic map illustrating the world's disproportionate population and wealth distribution. Here you have population. You can see the size of Asia, where you have China with 1.2 million, India almost a billion people now, 1.2 billion people in China, India with about 900 million, Africa with about three times the size of the United States, and Latin America. There's the relative size of these segments of the world over against the United States and Western Europe. But you take a look then at the gross national product. If you can keep this in mind, and you see what the GNP is, you see what happens to the world immediately. It changes considerably, with the United States garnering about a third of the world's national product or global product, and Africa 2.12%. Huh? Quite a difference. And you lay those two maps one upon the other, and you can see immediately that you have problems.
Is that Japan over there on the right-hand side?
That's right. Yep. That is Japan.
And Great Britain That's right.
That's right.
And Scandinavia is where just
about. I would guess this is Scandinavia here.
Yeah.
And where is the United States?
North America, that includes friends from Canada and the United States.
This is the second map that Africa had a white section on.
Yes. What do you think that is?
South Africa.
South Africa. That's right.
Yeah. Because that's first world, huh?
Okay.
See here? First world, second world, third world is the black.
We don't have Russia's gross national product.
Well, they get about 17% of the global product. And that's Eastern Europe, it's not Russia.
Right.
Then if you have, I think, one more that may be of interest to you, if you superimpose upon the world through computer enhancement, if it stays in mind, here is a cartogram of expenditures for military purposes. Huh? And here again you see the Soviet Union here and the United States here. An interesting one, to me anyhow, is that you have Israel right there. How much it expends, huh? And West Germany.
Where's Japan?
Well, Japan, we know, spends 1% only, huh?
Right. They
probably don't even appear, right. You see. It's too small. So that's a view of the world that enhances our idea that the third world is something else. I want to read from an economist who's pretty well known, Robert Heilbronner. When he tries to describe the third world, he draws the following picture. We begin by invading the house of our imaginary American family to strip it of all its furniture. What he's trying to do now is to achieve for us what it would be like if we lived on the third world status and level. Huh? We invade the house of our imaginary American family to strip it of its furniture. Everything goes: beds, chairs, table, television sets, lamps. We will leave the family with a few old blankets, a kitchen table, a wooden chair, and along with the bureaus, of course, go the clothes. Each member of the family may keep in his wardrobe his oldest suit or dress, a shirt or a blouse. We will permit a pair of shoes for the head of the family, but none for the wife or children. We move to the kitchen. The appliances have already been taken out, so we'll turn to the cupboards. The box of matches may stay, a small bag of flour, some sugar and salt. A few moldy potatoes, already in the garbage can, must be hastily rescued, for they will provide much of tonight's meal. We will leave a handful of onions and a dish of dried beans. All the rest we will take away, the meat, the fresh vegetables, the canned goods, the crackers, the candy. Now we have stripped the house. The bathroom has been dismantled, the running water shut off, the electric wires taken out, and next we take away the house. The family can move into the woodshed. Communications must go next. No newspapers, magazines, books. Not that they'll be missed anyway, since we must also take away the family's illiteracy as well. Instead, in our shanty town, we'll allow one radio. Now government services must go. No more postmen, no more firemen. There is a school, but is 3 miles away and consists of two classrooms. There are, of course, no hospitals or doctors nearby. The nearest clinic is 10 miles away and is tended by a midwife. It can be reached by bicycle, provided the family has a bicycle, which is most unlikely. And finally, money. We will allow our family a cash hoard of $5. This will prevent our breadwinner from experiencing the tragedy of an Iranian peasant who went blind because he could not raise the $3.94 which he mistakenly thought he needed to receive admission to a hospital where he could have been cured. That's quite a picture. One of the things they talked about is cash. In many parts of the world, in Ethiopia, it's less than $150 per person per year. Here it's around $12,000 or $13,000. Sweden is even higher. What do you think about that kind of picture that Heilbronner paints? How does that fit into our wildest imagination of what the other world really is like? Well, it's not easy. It's not easy to realize that life expectancy, for example, in many countries in West Africa, Niger, for example, is 41 years. We enjoy 74 to 76, depending on gender. It's not easy to understand that most people in the third world are illiterate. Most people in the third world, in fact, tonight will go to bed unable to read or write cat or dog. It's a world that is difficult for us who live in North America to understand or appreciate. For example, hunger. I don't know how many of you have ever had. I know many of us will say, I'm so hungry I could eat a horse. But we've never, hunger is a time when you want food and you don't know when you're going to get it again. Well, some of us have been hungry. I'm sure that Dick Buescher here, when he's out packing, maybe is hungry and can't wait till he gets to a campsite, but at least he knows he's going to get something to eat. Hunger is when you are hungry, you want food, but you don't know when that next meal is going to come from. The worst earthquake in the history of the world happened, 10, 12 years ago, just northeast of Beijing, China, when 242,000 people died. Hunger kills that many people in just 6 days. Indeed, if you take all the people who have been killed in all the wars and revolutions in the last 150 years, it won't even come close to how many people die of hunger in a year. And that's the third world. That's one of the realities. It's that world that we're only a sixth of. We, in this case, the only figures I have, I'm sorry to say, are for the United States. We make up a sixth of the world's population. And yet we consume, for example, 36% of the world's energy.
Is that 1/6 or 6%?
6%. Did I say 1/6?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Yeah, 6%. 6%. Yeah. And we could go and take a look at the fact that, we could break it down into a village and talk about Americans and 100 village and how much the United States would make. Only 6 out of 100 would be Americans and the rest would be non-Americans. But I'm sure you've had all of those little drills. It's a world, for example, when I was in India once, I remember going into a house, if you can call it that, where I had to stoop and to get into the door and even to stand up. I couldn't stand up in the house. And yet in that little house that maybe wasn't any larger than the circle, if you squared it off, lived the man and his wife, four children, and her parents, the mother's parents. It's a world where OSHA isn't even known. You know what OSHA is, huh? Organization for Safety, whatever it is. Yeah. I mean, I've seen people chipping granite, little children and women, without any glasses or anything, and they're just sitting there on the road. It's a world where women, and that's one thing we didn't put up there, or maybe we did, women exploitation. Yeah. Where the women, of course, have the children. They make the meals. They fetch the water. They gather the wood. They plant the corn. They weed the fields. The women's work is never done. It's constantly on. In India, I was once, and I saw an old woman at the edge of a crowd where we, LWR, have been making a, doing some work in the village, supporting a project. And I asked my guest quietly, I said, you see that lady over at the edge of the crowd, the one that's bent over and gnarled and fingers gnarled and dirty under the fingernails and straight gray hair and her breasts hung there like two shoestrings, largely toothless. And I asked my host, how old is she? And he looked at her and said, oh, I guess she's mid-30s. Mid-30s. But then you see, if she were living in Niger, she would have a life expectancy of only 5 more years. And you can understand why. Or the woman I saw in Ethiopia, who put 50 kilos of grain on her back, which is about 104 pounds, 105 pounds, and ran off to bring that to her family with no shoes on. And this road out here that we have right outside would be a paved highway compared to what she had to cross. Huh? But that was her fate in life. Norm, or the woman, yeah.
How much of the exploitation of women can be attributed to the dominant religions in the third world?
Not so much religion as, I think, cultural. And maybe religion plays an impact on that. But I think it's more cultural than anything else.
Then the reverse, I guess, would be to what extent are the dominant religions trying then to reverse the situation?
Well, you know, we work largely, you know, when you make me think about that, I think of Latin America, where maybe the dominant religion is Christianity.
Right.
And I don't see much effort being taken there to reverse that trend. Women there do, again, so much of the work. They're the ones who go and fetch the water and carry it. You mentioned the other day when you were backpacking, water weighs, I believe, 8 pounds a gallon. And you carry 5 gallons on your head, you're carrying 40 pounds. And they carry it. And they carry it for 10 miles or more sometimes. Jerry?
I was wondering what's happened with the emphasis on microenterprises. And Bud for the World, I know, within the last couple of years has been working with others to try to encourage getting money down to the level of enterprises operated by women, you know, that would be sustainable, since women are really the food producers, are
sure.
they not? Do you see any hope in that, or?
Yes, I would say, you know, but it's going to be, Jerry, a long, 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 long time.
Uh-huh.
It isn't going to happen overnight. We have, for example, what in the country, in the third world, they're no longer in the third world, maybe they're in the second world now. What is known in the trade as NICs, N-I-C, newly industrial countries. Among those are South Korea, Malaysia, Singapore, Taiwan. But they all had something going for them, and that was not a very low educational rate. They had schooling, and they had a lot of influx of money. And we're pouring money into many of these areas, but it's going to take a long time before we educate people. An organization known as Trickle Down is giving small entrepreneurs $50 to start up a bakery somewhere, and they pay that back. But it's going to take a long time, and that's another thing that we Americans have got to appreciate. And this, I should say, we North Americans and we Western Europeans, and that is that development is going to take a long time. And I suppose that's one thing that got me a little upset when I experienced We Are the World, a great effort. And a lot of people went out and bought records and went out and bought t-shirts. But we were given the impression that, you know, $50 million was going to solve the problem. Those $50 million are going to be helpful, but they're going to go, they're not going to go anywhere close to solving the problem. We're going to have to, the world is going to have to be billions and billions and tens of billions of dollars for decades before some of this will begin to work, before we will begin to see the efforts of a Bread for the World. The effort is great, but don't expect any great results tomorrow. Look for them 20, 30 years from now, maybe.
You think education is one of the basics there?
Sure is. It sure is. We have some of the things up here. For example, high population. And we know for a fact that the more educated the woman, the lower the population rate. I mean, you don't have to go out and teach birth control or all of these other aspects. If you educate women, the birth rates will drop. And that's an interesting thing. And so LWR, for example, tries to go out in the third world and tries to educate women. And we do that in Bangladesh, we do it in Kenya, we do it in Swaziland, we do it in Zimbabwe, to name a few. But education is surely. Why did Europe do so well after the war when we brought in the Marshall Plan? People said, we need a Marshall Plan for Africa. Hey, what did Europe have? Skilled carpenters, plumbers, teachers, you listed. They had them, yeah, all those things. You don't have that in Africa or other places. There's so many things in that other world that we have to think about. The realities of that other world defy you, unless, like Miss Lewis, you've lived in the Cameroons. And I wonder, Miss Lewis, if you have any observations about the Cameroons or life in Africa. You've lived there for 20 years as a missionary.
Well, you know, this idea came up about the desire for first world status, but amongst the people in the bush, I don't think there is a whole lot of that. Now, I was right next to the Central African Republic, and the government there was trying to get people to raise coffee, you know, work on coffee plantations. But they had to send people out there to force them to work. Those people weren't interested in earning a lot of money to get other things. They were satisfied with their own gardens and their own hunting, the things that they had. And it was a struggle to get them to work that way to earn extra money. That wasn't any incentive for them.
Yes, and that's another thing. Would you say, therefore, that these people in the third world are lazy?
Well, certainly the women aren't.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But even the men aren't, and yet they're...
Of looking at things.
Yeah, that's right. They have a different way of looking at things. They're not lazy. I've seen farmers in Kenya, for example, plant their crops three times, hoping to get rain at the right time. They look at things differently. Reminds me of a fellow who applied for a job, and the personnel officer said, how many days in the week begin with T? And he said, you don't have to give me the answer right now. If you want to go home and think about it and come back tomorrow, you can. So the guy came back tomorrow and the next day and said, okay, how many days of the week begin with T? The guy said, two. He said, that's right. What are they? He said, today and tomorrow. Well, the personnel officer said, well, he said, you know, that's, you're looking at things a little differently. He said, tell me, how many seconds are there in a year? You don't have to tell me right now, just go home and think about it. Guy came back the next day and he said, well, how many seconds are there in the year? And the guy said, 12. He said, 12 seconds in the year? How do you figure that? He said, the 2nd of January, 2nd of February, 2nd of March. He said, no. And the personnel officer said, well, yeah, he said, well, you know, this guy is thinking a little differently. He said, I want to give you one more question. How many D's, the letter D, are there in Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer? Go home and think about it, come back the next day. So the guy came back the next day and said, 157. 157, he said, don't tell me I'm wrong. I've counted them twice and I know I'm right. And the personnel officer said, well, let me, how did you come to that conclusion? He said, dee 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 dee. So we look at things differently. And we do. I remember when I was in South Africa. A visitor from England was visiting his South African friend. And the story has it that they were sitting on the porch and the South African said to the Englishman, you know, these people think differently than we do. He said, I'll show you what I mean. He said, Josh, one of his boys, as they call him in South Africa, would you come here? He said, would you run down to the club and see if I'm there? Josh dutifully ran down the street, down to the club, came back in about 5 minutes and said, no boss, you ain't there. And the South African turned to his English friend and said, you see, they think differently than we do. But as Josh was walking away, he turned to one of his colleagues and said, you know, the boss is sure funny. He could have telephoned the club to see if he was there. And we miss so often. We miss because we come from different perspectives. And so we think that what they do is funny. Like this one here. It's not a bad idea, desire first world status. I'm not sure they really do, you know. Yes,
no, but out there, I was talking to one Frenchman that was working out there at coffee plantations or some such thing. And he said, well, you know, the people back there, well, in France and America, they work hard and long, you know, to get enough income so that they can retire and they can live comfortably. Well, the Africans don't have to do that. They have it right now.
Yes. That's very true. That's a view that many of them have.
Hey, Norm, you're probably aware that there's a University of Wisconsin cartographer who this past year developed a different map.
Yes, shows Johnson, I think.
Yes, that National Geographic can use it now. And it's much different, obviously, than years, because Africa is by far the largest element on the map. It's more percentage-wise depicted more accurately.
Yeah, that's right. That's a very good map. And then, of course, there's the Peter projection map. I'm sure that you've all seen at one time or another, which shows these countries in terms of land mass in direct proportion. So you can see that Africa is four times the size. But many people don't like this map. Some people have even referred to it as the Christian map. It's not that. It's really north and south to try and depict the size. But the Johnson map, yes, by that cartographer at the Wisconsin, is the latest map that tries to eliminate problems that this one has. But it's all attempts to put the round globe on a flat piece of paper are going to be distorted. The Mercator projection, you could navigate by that. You cannot navigate by this map. But Sudan, for example, the largest country in Africa, is in direct proportion to the United States, and Sudan is the same size as the United States east of the Mississippi. And that's another problem that they have. We have here high population, and it's true, but I can point out, for example, that high population doesn't mean third world or economic collapse. The highest country with the highest or densest population growth, does anyone know our rate? I'm sorry, let me rephrase it. The country with the highest density of population, anybody know where it is in the world?
Indonesia.
Japan.
India. Belgium.
Getting close over here. Holland. Holland. And nobody would say it's a third world country. Take Hong Kong. Take Singapore. So high population doesn't necessarily mean that you're a third world country. But it's with the other aspects, huh? Low education and poor health conditions. For example, in Ethiopia, there is one doctor for every 26,000, roughly, people. In the United States, we have one doctor for about 550 people. So when you start having those kind of problems, then population, of course, is a factor.
When are you going to tell us how you direct your effort and your priorities? Or are you?
Well, I was thinking of, I was thinking of doing that, actually, because I'm going to be here sometime next week, but I can do that now if you wish. LWR, Lutheran World Relief, which is your relief and development organization, sponsors programs and projects in about 45 countries around the world, either bilaterally ourselves or in support of Lutheran World Federation in Geneva. And we hold no bias with regard to gender or race or creed or anything like that, political viewpoint. It doesn't bother. We are ready to help anywhere provided help is needed. We have about 300 projects in the world. The main areas of our interest, one is water enhancement. Water for personal use, water for crop, water for stock. When you realize that 80% of the diseases known to man are born by water, it's important that people have clean water. And so we try to provide that. A second area is food production. Because after water, we feel that food comes next. Then, not necessarily in ranking, but we have, for example, literacy to try and teach people how to read. We are interested in some medical work, small clinics down at the grassroots level. We're interested in community development. By community development, we mean getting a community to work together to meet their needs. Huh? Yes, go ahead.
The rationale of the number of countries, and I don't know what kind of money you're talking about, 5 million a year? 10?
That we get from the church?
that you spend on these projects, 10 million or?
No, last year our total budget was around $30 million.
30. Okay.
But much of that comes from the U.S. government in terms of food.
Okay. And you admit this is a drop in the bucket.
Yep.
It's an important drop in the bucket, I don't know.
Yes.
So you do spread that out quite a bit.
Yes.
And I guess that's what I was getting at. If a given country or area or section is in dire need, why do you not say for the next 5 years or 10 or something, let's help get this group? Now, Ms. Lewis, I don't want to take all this, but does this group need help?
In the Cameroons.
Where she was?
Sure, I'm sure.
I don't know that, and I guess I would say from what she said, I did not get that impression.
Well, that's just there are other things to consider, like the matter of medical care, which is very, very important.
But not hungry.
I wouldn't say that in Cameroon yet, is it? I haven't been there for a
time. No, they have pretty well. They feed themselves quite well in Cameroon.
So on the pecking order, they're above some of the places,
yes.
Many of the places.
Yeah. What you're saying is, why don't we concentrate on one country, for example,
well,
or one area?
Yeah. Where are the priorities, and is hunger, your water thing is a hunger related?
Sure, absolutely. You know, we get into countries by different means. We are, for example, we got into Nicaragua in 1972, was it, when they had that great earthquake. We went in there on a relief basis, and we've been supporting the Council of Churches, Nicaragua Council of Churches, since that time. We got into Peru through an earthquake. We're in Western Africa through the Great Sahelian Drought of 1974. We're in Sudan because of the drought of 84 and 85, and Ethiopia because of that same drought. You get into these places by unusual means sometimes.
By demand.
By demand. And then when you get there, you see that there's more that you can do. We get into it because sometimes a missionary will say, hey, now we have Barbara Rossing is doing the Bible studies. Well, I know her sister Jane up on the Senegal River between Mauritania and Senegal. Just recently, the Mauritanians and the Senegalese have had a falling out, and each country kicked the natives of the other country out, back to their own place. Well, in Mauritania, you've got some like 80,000 refugees. They've been kicked out of Senegal. What do you do? So sometime a missionary group will say, can you come in here with aid and help us? And so in India, we were working through the church. The Lutheran churches in India. In the Philippines, it was the Lutheran Church, and it was Lutheran World Service. Plus, you see, the reason why we, I suppose, don't concentrate in one country is that people in the southwest part of the United States, Texas, Mexico, New Mexico, and all, they have a lot of people from Mexico in their area who have relatives in Hispanic-speaking areas, and they say, hey, we want you to do something in El Salvador. So we do. We've got relatives in Guatemala. What are you doing there? And so for these various reasons, we go from one area to another. But, you know, someone said, how come you don't get discouraged? And I guess there would be two quotes I'd like to give. One by Edmund Burke, the English philosopher. He said, nobody made a greater mistake than he who did nothing because he could only do a little. And Bobby Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, has this to say, and I was surprised, not surprised, I guess I was, I didn't realize it's on his tomb in Arlington National Cemetery. Let no one be discouraged by the belief there is nothing one man or woman can do against the enormous array of the world's ills, against misery and ignorance, injustice and violence. Few will have the greatness to bend history itself, but each of us can work to change a small portion of events, and in the total of all these acts will be written the history of this generation. It is from the numberless diverse acts of courage and belief that human history is shaped. Each time a man stands up for an ideal, or strikes out against injustice, or acts to improve the lot of others, he sends a tiny ripple of hope, and crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring, those ripples build a current which can sweep away the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance. You know, that's, I suppose, LWR and everybody. You have to have the hope that you can do something. And we think we are doing something together with many other people. Early?
Weren't you invited into the president 2 years ago and given the award as the finest food and care distributor in the world from America?
Well, from the United States, yes.
And the lowest cost, about 4-5% distribution costs, whereas some get 29%.
Oh, yes. Yes.
I was in the Cameroons too. My wife and I spoke there 2.5 years ago. What really intrigued me was that in their simple lifestyle, they lived together on these naked surfaces, the villages, and they lived together happily, joyfully. They meet together at night and talk for 2 hours by the fireplace. It's just amazing. And I thought when I saw that half the medicine done by the Roman Catholic and Lutheran churches in the whole country of the Cameroons, and when I saw what was done for the poor, one agronomist from Iowa is attempting to find a hybrid to, how do you say, not quadruple, but decaduple, the amount that you can produce with the same inch of soil. He's sure he can find it. So that a plenty of food supply, they didn't eat all the junk. We discovered there's nothing that they work with that isn't biodegradable, except now they're bringing in beer and Coke. Coke costs about 4 cents a bottle to make, and they charge $2.50 to folks who make 10, 25 cents an hour, maybe a dollar a day, feeding them.
Yeah.
But the joy in their lives put us to shame. They don't have all the junk.
Yeah.
Is this situation somewhat common to what the Indian was many years ago? Say 150 years ago, the Indian has never been really gotten into the society of the United States. They've always rejected it, basically. They had their own way and they were happy. Now, is this what we have in Africa? That they really, as it was mentioned, they really didn't care about that status, they really didn't care to make that money, they really didn't care about all those gimmicks, which we really don't need. And are they just going to be happy, and is it going to be a waste of effort in the long run? Because it really was with the Indian. The Indian still wants his way of life and his land and his old hunting. He hasn't changed any. And I'm wondering about the Africans.
No, the African, by and large, the modern African, wants a better life for his children. He wants them to be educated. He wants them to enjoy many of the things that the first world enjoys. But he wants to do it at his own pace, I think. You know, I think one of our problems in much of the third world, and in particularly Africa, where I've lived 7 years, you know, we expect to go there and get a Big Mac. We expect them to be Democrats in our image. We don't necessarily expect to get a Big Mac when we go to China. We'll eat chop suey. You know, the Africans have got a form of government. They had states that, and this is part of the lecture I want to give on Africa later this week. They had states that were larger and bigger than anything they had in Europe, in medieval Europe. The library at Timbuktu, and we often chuckle about, you know, from here to Timbuktu, but there is a place, Timbuktu, in Mali. It rivaled the University of Paris in 1250. I mean, you couldn't even compare it as being a center of learning when you compare it to Timbuktu. I think we have to get to know these people. Edmund Burke, again, I'll quote him, the philosopher. Story has it, he was walking down the street with his secretary, male secretary, and Burke picked up his cane, walking cane, and pointed at a man across the street and said, "You know, I hate that man." And the secretary said, "Well, Dr. Burke, you don't even know him." He said, "Precisely. Precisely.
Because you don't know.
Because you don't know. And you got to know these people, and to get to know them, and then you'll understand that they want the same things. They want to be able to live to 74 and 76 years of age, of course."
That's where the comparison of the American Indian makes sense, because the American Indian was living compatibly in their environments, but there were wealthy culturally and environmentally tribes and poor tribes long before we interfered. And then the hate between the white man and the Indian developed because we wanted a portion of their environment that left them too much, too little to be in compatibility with it anymore, and we didn't know them. They were savages by our judgment color. So they're, you know, I don't see them as a good comparison to the present situation. Question I've got, Norman, is the relief effort has appeared to me to be, and even from what you've said, emphasized as a tactical response rather than a strategic response. And are the World Health Organizations trying to approach a strategy that would go from just subsistence and when that is even possible and saving lives to actually bettering, someday solving the problem?
Well, they are. An example of that is, for example, the stamping out of smallpox. There was a strategic effort on the part of WHO, the World Health Organization, to eliminate this scourge. I can travel now around the world, and if I didn't have to have a yellow fever shot, I wouldn't even have to bring my yellow medical thing because there is no smallpox. And this is the foolishness of what we're doing, I think, when we, for example, Congress appropriates money for 1 year instead of for 10 years or something like that. Huh? We put $50 million into the program to eradicate smallpox. We have saved hundreds of millions of dollars as a result, because no longer do we need clinics. We no longer need doctors at the port of entry to check to see if you got smallpox, because we know you haven't got it. We don't have to give those shots anymore. You know, the whole thing is so changed. So that a small $50 million, and that's the exact figure we put in, has garnered for us hundreds of million dollars of benefits. Why aren't we willing to put in billions of dollars over a long period of time? And, you know, take a look at what Korea has done. I mean, they're exporting to us now. They're buying our product. They're buying our agricultural products. They're buying our industrial products, huh? Because they got the wherewithal to do it. If they were still like they were after the war, they wouldn't be able to do it. The point is, you're right, Dick. We are tactically trying to beat the problem when we should be doing it strategically. Long term, we have to. Development is not the 100-yard dash of relief. Development is the 26-mile, 385-yard run of the marathon. Only we Americans want instant coffee, instant tea, instant milk, instant potatoes, and instant development. It just isn't to be had. And, you know, if there's nothing else, one of the problems in this world of global issues is for us Americans, for we Americans, to begin to see some of these long-term implications and not expect a solution to problems overnight, because they're not going to come. and that's unfortunate. So we have to change our approach. And that means, you know, we've got to change our outlook to many of these problems. Whether we can do it or not, whether we are willing to do it or not, we can do it. It's a matter of will. Any comments?
It occurs to me that you have a practical problem of identifying these investments that have the high payout, smallpox eradication you mentioned. Because I think there are a lot of other examples where people can have mentioned that people essentially pour money and get nothing out of it. Do you have any thoughts or advice or guidelines as to what these are or how we identify them?
Well, you know, I think, for example, one is education. We have had a project submitted to us by a couple of Lutheran professors. They're both retired in their 70s, and they were very effective in India, for example, in setting up in all the Indian states a agricultural extension service, like I'm sure you have here in the far west, but I'm thinking of Michigan Extension Service, I'm sure Washington State and Oregon State, we all have extension services. But you realize that in Africa, for example, there aren't any PhDs in agronomy. There aren't any PhDs in soil sciences. There aren't any PhDs in animal husbandry. Well, these two professors suggested that this began to occur in Africa. They set it up in India. India today has an extension service very similar to ours. It's going to cost millions and millions and billions of dollars. Well, we can't handle it. We're not large enough. We sent it on to Lutheran World Federation, and they said they weren't interested. But I think that this is the kind of program we need, so that the African agriculturalists, because as Ms. Lewis and Erling can tell you, the Cameroons can feed a lot of people. So can other parts of Africa. And what you need, though, are extension services that train the farmers locally. There's no sense bringing somebody, I don't think, from Africa to the United States or to Europe. Because once they've seen Paris, you're not going to get them to go back down on the farm again. And therefore, you got to train them in Africa, in country. Don't take them to Hawaii and show them how to do it. Do it in country. That's one program, for example. I think that could be done. Another program that has to be done, and we'll talk about that a little later this week, is to reverse the trend in the field of ecology. And that's what these two books are all about, Our Common Future and The State of the World. The desert in Africa, are you ready for this? Is expanding every second of the day and night by the size of two football fields. Think of it. Going on all the time. And what does that mean? That means, you know, you're going to get less production from this, and I'm over, from what they're planning, huh? And they're going to have to go to other areas that aren't going to be able to support agriculture.